Who are you?
It was Mickey Mouse.
Are they slow moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Shall I say more, but I don't want to ruin the surprise.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Planet of Terror podcast. Tonight, I'm joined by a very special guest, writer-director Barbara Stepanski of the independent horror feature Fugue. Welcome, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you.
I appreciate you joining me on the show today.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So for those of our listeners that haven't heard about the film, just give a kind of a brief synopsis. Our film starts off with a young woman and her older husband as they move into a new hillside house. Almost immediately, pretty much from the word go, supernatural happenings begin to start happening in the house. You know, you're kind of your typical bumps and thumps in the night, so to speak. And not much longer thereafter, our supernatural presence actually makes itself known within the house. But just kind of when you think the story will take the shape of a standard paranormal haunting, we learn that the husband is hiding a secret, and that an accident actually befell upon our young woman not too long ago. Our film then takes on a much different shape midway through the actual story itself. So I know that doesn't really get into too much specifics, so I wanted to try to make it as spoiler-free as possible.
Please.
So tell me a little bit more about the film, Barbara, and kind of the idea behind it.
Kind of how it came about, or
just kind of how it came about.
Well, me and the writer of the script, Matt Harry, we had another project that was also a thriller to make, and we were facing some road bumps along the way of getting that made that actually needed, you know, a proper budget. And we were sitting in my house, which is the house, incidentally, that you see in the film. And I said to Matt, you know all these friends with cameras and equipment. We could just shoot something here. So can you just go off and write something for me? And so he liked the idea. We were both really eager to just get something finally produced. And he and I sat down and thought about all the films that we love and the atmospheres that we enjoy, and to see if we can cheaply do that in and around the house. And really the films that we love are, you know, simple ghost stories like The Haunting or the original one. And The Others, which was a very simple story in a house. And The Innocents, the original, which was all stories that terrify on a very psychological level. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the events are in your head. And so we thought, well, that would be a perfect way to go. We love these films and we want to emulate something like that, like really have an effect on people, scare them, do something fun, and get it done for relatively little money. So that's how it all came about.
As is mostly the case with most independent features, right? Try to evoke that sense of realism, but at the same time, try to be mindful of kind of the resources you have at hand.
Yeah, exactly. And Matt and I both went to USC film school, so we're coming from a very commercial background, I want to say. And so in a way, you know, you could probably remake our film with Sandra Bullock, and it wouldn't change all that much. You know? It's a very commercial little flick in an indie form.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Although they're probably, if they were to remake it, it'd probably be all CGI'd to hell, right?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, we were really lucky that we had amazing friends working on it, and we have a friend who works actually for DreamWorks and is a visual effects artist who supervised all of our visual effects. So that was amazing.
Wow, that was great. So he just kind of helped pitch in?
Yeah, he took all our footage, and we told him what we needed in all those little shots. And at the time, I had very little experience with shooting visual effects, so I hadn't shot a lot of the play necessarily. and he still managed to pull everything off. So, yeah.
Wow, that's great. So one of the things that I really liked or enjoyed about the film from the early goings is, so when I kind of mentioned that supernatural happenings start occurring within the house, and you kind of hear your bumps and thumps in the night, but some of your other tropes that you typically have in that subgenre of horror, where you know, our lead character Charlotte, who's played by Abigail Mattel, you know, there's certain moments where she looks in the mirror, and you expect something happen, but it doesn't. Or at night she wakes up and she looks outside and nothing happens, but you expect something to happen and it doesn't, and it kind of preys on your mind a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an aspect of the film that I really appreciated, and I kind of wanted to note, was that a conscious effort?
Oh yeah. Before I shot the film, I had read a quote, and I know it was a well-known filmmaker, but I don't remember who. A quote somewhere that said, the thing about horror, or, you know, these thriller movies, is you kind of make them deliberately boring for a really long time, and then, you know, you give a bang.
Right.
So I thought, okay, that I actually took that to heart and tried to draw out some of these moments where that you expect something to happen all the time, and then sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So it's to keep you on your toes, I guess.
Yep.
But yeah, apparently that's what you do.
and of course you did just a phenomenal job too of just the other half of that, right? Is creating a sense of atmosphere and kind of like this a sense of kind of foreboding dread.
Yes, thank you. Like the other part of the equation was to emulate Hitchcock a little bit, in the old-fashioned style, like films like Marnie and Vertigo, where it's you're in the eyes of the protagonist, and so you really kind of feel the phobias and the traumas coming up, but you know, it's all very pulpy in that way. So, yeah.
So getting back to, you know, just kind of the, what we kind of talked about, and just, and how you kind of built it up, and just kind of developing this build towards a larger something. So to that point, I thought it was a great turn when we do see our kind of apparition, if you will, for the first time. And I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying this, that it's done in broad daylight. And I thought that was something that was pretty remarkable for a supernatural type of thriller film. You know, typically it's at night, and, you know, that the darkness or what you don't see is kind of what preys on the mind. But to do it, like, out in broad daylight was very well done, to where it was just as frightening of an experience had it been at night, or, again, when you typically see or experience a haunting type of a film.
Yeah, again, that was a little twofold. It was also deliberate to do a lot of scares in the daytime because we first budgetary, because we can't shoot well at night on a camera that doesn't it needs a lot of light to function. But also, we did want to make both daylight and night frightening. So you didn't know what to expect, and it could come from any corner. Now, I have to say, you know, I was a little worried about that because I do find the night more frightening than daylight, and I really thought, well, is anybody going to be moved by this? But then one of my favorite scenes did turn out to be that moment when she is in the backyard and discovers that hole in the ground and discovers the tooth, which I don't think I'm giving away much either, since we have a bunch of this stuff in the trailer.
Yeah.
But that scene is one of my favorites that we've cut together. I love that shot with the blood in the eyes. that Abby does so well.
Yeah, it was just, it was phenomenal. Like I said, like, it was just, I was just shocked that it was pulled off just so effectively, and it startled you as a viewer, because you weren't, you know, you train your brain in certain ways, you know, when you watch it. If, for any fan of horror, we try to pick it out as we go along, right? We expect things to happen at certain times, and when it kind of hits you from, you know, kind of blindsides you in a way, when and it turns out to be just so well done as it was, I was just in awe of it, and I was like, wow.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, and you just kind of, wow, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Off that.
And actually, it was funny, while we were developing the script, Matt sent me a draft, like the first complete draft, and he called me and said, before you read it, I just want you to know I did something. Something happened, and I just went with it. The Bigfoot Act reveal that happened. And that was unplanned. We did not put that in the outline. And this big third act twist. And so... And I read it, and I was equally like, oh, my God, but this is great. This is so much better than what we had before. So it was a tons of these little discoveries along the way that just happened out of sheer being engrossed in this creative process of getting it done as fast as possible and then shooting it as fast as possible. It was really fun.
Wow, it all came together just great.
Thank you.
So to kind of talk about that twist a little bit without really revealing anything again, being so cryptic.
I know, sorry.
No, it's cool. So to kind of play into the kind of medical terminology of the name of the film, so, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think we'd be giving too much away talking about that, but so, you know, we learn about... We learn about the accident that, you know, that happened with Charlotte, and, you know, there was some trauma there, and we really then start to figure out and piece it together of what actually did happen to her. And, you know, as mentioned in my brief synopsis, you know, there's her husband is holding back a larger truth that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That balancing act that occurs with the film where you move from the supernatural and pretty much do a complete 180 in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, you almost go to a different genre of film, and I don't really want to talk about it too much because, again, I don't want to give away or give any sort of inclination to, you know, what that twist could be. But if you could talk about that for a little bit, and how was there ever a concern as a director of going, you know, we're pretty much just moving out of the realm of supernatural into something else? And, you know, for me personally, you know, I've seen lots of horror films, and of course, and, you know, I've ran my blog for a while, so I've seen a lot of bad films and a lot of good films. And there's definitely those types of films that tries to be too many things to people, right? They try to have the kind of like this kitchen sink mentality of, what am I going to be? Am I going to be a zombie film or an end of the world type film? And let's try to maybe have an air of the supernatural thrown in for good measure, just to appeal to that crowd. But the way that you delicately balance the film and how it moves very seamlessly from the supernatural to this next, you know, pretty much last act of the film.
Yeah.
Again, if you could talk about that briefly and how you as a director kind of balance that.
Well, yeah, and again, we're not giving much away because, again, it's in the trailer that something happened to her. She's in this fugue state, and and it might not all be supernatural. The question we wanted to pose for people as they're watching the film, is it supernatural or maybe not? And if not, why and how? And if maybe that trauma plays into her being sensitive, as she says in the movie, to phenomena around her. That was fascinating to me because I'm coming from a scientific background. I did physics in college. And so I always like to incorporate an element of science in things, well, if it's possible. And so when I first thought of the idea is, you know, if you have been through this trauma and you don't know it really, would you perceive things differently? And so that's kind of where the idea was initially born out of. And then I feel like once things take off and you realize that that her mind is maybe playing tricks on her, that maybe there's a bigger secret behind her, then it does become a much more thriller-esque film, but it happened organically within the storytelling. It's almost like as a child you ask yourself all the time, oh, okay, and then what happens? So this happened, and then what happens? And it's just this organic journey of, well, then this happened, and then this happened, and it just felt like we were moving very, very logically, I want to say, from A to B. So it was, what I tried to do is to just execute the script as well as possible, and that means that, you know, a lot of the work you put into the story development and try to make that work for you emotionally.
Right.
So it didn't actually really never occurred to me that we switched genres or, you know, went into a different world until we were in post-production.
Oh, really?
Where it was like, oh, we've gone away from the supernatural and it's becoming much more action-packed and thriller-esque. But, you know, we went with it and had fun with that. Yeah.
Have you seen the French thriller, or, well, it's probably more horror than thriller, but definitely has some thriller aspects that your film kind of reminded me of a bit in certain parts, was Inside.
Yeah, we've been compared to Inside a lot, and I'm so sorry I still haven't seen I haven't seen it. I can't really say anything about it at this point, but yes, we've had that comparison.
Definitely check it out. It's a great film. It's within my top 10 from the past decade for sure.
Yeah, it's on my Netflix queue list.
Awesome. Well, so along the same vein, though, I mean, if you think about it within context, I mean, completely different film, but I mean, in terms of, I guess really the whole thought or premise behind it was, you had emailed me and told me you had saw a screening of I Saw the Devil on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think about that?
Oh, I loved it. It was so much fun. It's funny. There's so much great material coming out of South Korea right now.
It's amazing. It's like, what's in the water over there?
I know. It's like, push the envelope.
Yeah.
And don't seem to have that sort of mental censorship that
right.
We have here. Yeah, I Saw the Devil was a revenge movie that was extremely violent, extremely well performed, and I was very riveted by that film. I thought maybe it was a little long, but yeah.
I think it was a little bit long. That's probably my only gripe, that it was a little bit long and drawn out, and I felt like it was too much cat and mouse at times. Where I was just like, I wanted him to end it, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
But overall, a pretty great film.
It was.
I thought the cinematography was pretty fantastic, too.
It was really great. It's terrific. And, yeah, I thought the point was that he keeps drawing it out, and at this point you just switch, you switch sides. You just wanted to end it. And maybe that was the point that the filmmaker was making.
True.
So
I was stalking you on IMDb.com not too long ago.
Okay.
Looking at your film background. Now, is it true that you had a bit part in Christopher Nolan's film The Following?
Yes, that's true. I walked through the frame, I think, in minute 20-something.
Yeah.
However, my probably bigger contribution to Christopher Nolan's Following was that I was on the crew for the whole amount of that he was shooting it for, and that was a good year. And he has a really interesting story because he was shooting that film for a year over all Saturdays.
Wow.
And I was the camera assistant and clapper loader, and I was watching, I was also watching children which I was president of UCL Film Society at the time, so we had access to cameras, and Chris was a good friend, and he asked to borrow it, and I said, sure, if I can be on set and sort of watch out for it. He definitely taught me a lot about this guerrilla-style independent filmmaking. Like, from that experience, I learned a lot.
That was his first feature film, correct?
That was his first feature film. And one of his biggest accomplishments was to keep it cheap, you know, and doable, was to write the script to the locations that he had available. And he wrote the script to all of the apartments he knew he could get.
Wow.
And so it's, you know, it was very smart that way.
It's his only film I haven't seen yet. I think they just released it on Netflix streaming.
Oh, check me out. I had dark hair back then, too.
Oh, yeah?
But I literally just walked through the scene once. It's not a big deal. I was not a player as such. I just worked behind the scenes most of the time.
But being on the set for as long as you did, what did you learn the most from that experience?
He did a lot of rehearsals before he would shoot anything, because film was very costly in those days and everything was shot in film stock. So that was really interesting to watch him rehearse with his actors and really get the performance as close as possible as he could get it, with everybody knowing their blocking and where they're going to be. And then he didn't have to watch the performance anymore, because he was watching his camera work, because he was also a cinematographer on the project.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, you know, he just did a thing. And to be around that and kind of soak it in, that was a great pleasure.
Wow, that sounds great.
Yeah, that was fun.
So that kind of leads me into my next question. So tell me a little bit about your filmmaking influences, both past and present.
Oh, so many. I love movies, and I love to watch as many as possible. I think Sam Raimi is one of my big influences. I just love his work. And when I was working as a projectionist as a teenager, I watched Army of Darkness like a million times. And then Curtis Hanson is another one of my favorites, especially in his thriller world. Again, Hand That Rocks the Cradle was a really influential film for me. And then, you know, great filmmakers like Scorsese and David Fincher, still to this day, I find very inspiring.
She's amazing.
Yeah, I love his work. Oh, and then these days I go to this genre group every weekend. We go and meet up in a screening room at the American Film Institute and watch these genre films. So it's become this a staple in my life that every Sunday I have to be there, because they're going to show some amazing movie that I've never had access to. So I saw Martyrs that way, which I wouldn't have ever seen, I don't think, otherwise, which really blew me away at the time.
It's incredible. I mean, it's definitely one of those very gut-punching type of films, and something that just stays with you. And I found myself thinking about it for days, and just how it's just so applicable to so many different, like, life philosophies and religion and things like that.
Oh, yeah. It was one of these films that every 10 minutes it keeps changing plots on me, but, again, in a very organic way.
Right.
I think I figured it all out, and then he just pulls the carpet underneath your feet. It's such an interesting movie.
Yep. What else have you seen out of that club?
What else have we seen? Let me think. We've seen some action movies like Undisputed 3. We've had the director come in and talk to us. We saw some very rare Japanese movies that came out, like Love Exposure. I keep forgetting of the Dreamer, crazy movies that are just like an incredible novel. You feel like you've read a good novel and you want to be with these characters afterwards. We saw A Town Called Panic.
I haven't heard of that. Let's check this out.
We saw the Good, Bad, and the Weird, I think it's called. It's also from the same director that did the film we previously talked about. What's it called?
Was it I Saw the Devil?
Yes.
He did a
Western before I Saw the Devil. It was a very, very well shot piece.
I've heard of it, but I haven't checked it out yet. I think it's kind of like a throwback to your kind of spaghetti Western.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Very cool. So, getting back to kind of like your film career, so, you know, just kind of taking a look, and I saw that Hurt was just recently released on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So you're definitely not a stranger to the horror thriller genre. Do you have a preference for that genre, or is it just kind of stories that you've had that you've just wanted to tell?
Well, I did a thesis film in film school at AFI called The Trojan Cow, which was about a border crossing from East Germany to West Germany. And it contained a lot of thriller elements without me even being so much aware of it, because there's all this tension, are they going to make it across the border or not? And the film won a bunch of awards and did really well. It was even shortlisted for the Academy Awards, but then we didn't get in. And then the producers of Hurt really liked the material and thought that I might be a good fit for the movie that they had in mind. And so they literally hired me for this thriller, and I started to do a lot of homework and watch a lot of thrillers and horror films and see what is being done and to implement it into this film. And I really became obsessed with the genre because it became one of the few things that still made me feel things. Like, I felt scared, I felt, disgusted, but you know, there wasn't much that had impressed me before as much as good horror films. And so I thought, oh, wow, this is great. I want to be able to do this. And, you know, I'm still learning and I'm still improving on that. But to get that kind of a guttural reaction from the audience is really what I became interested in.
And I think that's the most amazing aspect of why I'm so drawn to the genre. Like, yeah, of course your mindless zombie flick is okay every now and then, but just kind of getting that gut reaction from folks from a film like Martyrs or from a film like Fugue, is just an amazing thing. And you just run that whole gamut of emotions when you connect with people on a level like that. And
if you're willing to commit, you know, I mean, you can sit back and say, oh, this is all humbug, I don't care, then that's fine, that's your choice. But if you're willing to sit there and commit and put yourself in the feet of your protagonist, it's just so much fun. It's the most fun genre.
Absolutely. I think so, too. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So I noticed that you recently contributed to the horror anthology film I Hate L.A., which my friend Elizabeth Fies has been involved in. So talk about that.
He's been a great friend and supporter.
Awesome. Talk about that experience a little bit. I've been following that progress, and I've been anxiously anticipating its release, and definitely want to check it out. How fun was that working with that group?
Oh, that was great. Liz came up to me and said that, hey, I have a camera, and I want everybody to shoot a movie about Los Angeles that's horror-related. And obviously there's a myriad of possibilities about Los Angeles, but... And so when she came to me, I said, I have to do something on road rage, because that's what I'm most drawn to, and I have this idea for a story. So she gave me all the equipment, basically, and produced my short, was always there every day, and it was a great fun. that we got a fantastic actress to be in it, Keiko Adena, who was in Gilmore Girls. And she usually plays the best friend character. And she played my girl that has road rage. So I'm very, very proud of that film. And I'm still actually finishing up sound for it. But hopefully as soon as it's going to be done, I want to submit it also individually to festivals. That'll take.
Very cool. That, it sounds like fun. It sounds like you guys have had a lot of fun with working on it and putting it together.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't so much involved in the final post-production part. Liz took most care of that, but I definitely contributed to the overall just feel, I guess.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's look out for Road Rage. I'll let you know when it's out at a festival somewhere.
Sounds good. I can't wait to check it out. So talk to me a little bit. So we had kind of mentioned about films before, you know, kind of getting enthralled by the works of Sam Raimi when you were younger and kind of some of the stuff you've seen recently. But what are some of your other favorite films that have kind of influenced you as well?
Just generally speaking? I think Star Wars was a big influence on me, I'm afraid to say, because it was a film I saw very late in life, and again was fascinated by how what a great story that was.
How old were you when you first saw it?
I was 16.
Wow!
And not when it came out. It was like, you know, years later after it had come out. I just kind of missed it when I was a kid. And E.T. was one of the films that I loved. And then Mrs. Brisby and The Secret of Nim was one of the films of all time, which is an animated film about a mouse. However, it's very scary.
I've heard of it. It's one I never saw as a kid.
Yeah. So those are kind of all-time favorites. And then, you know, Fincher came along and... I actually was one of the few people that really liked Alien 3. Talking of the Alien series, Alien is probably my favorite movie of all time. And one of those really perfect screenplays, I think.
Absolutely. Do you have a preference? Which one do you think is better, the first one or the second?
Oh, absolutely the first one. No contest. The second is just a different genre for me altogether. It doesn't scare me all that much.
Yeah.
Just things explode, which is fun.
Yeah.
But, yeah. but I definitely prefer the first one. The Fog, an all-time favorite. John Carpenter's The Fog. Yeah.
Very cool. So, do you have a favorite decade for horror?
Do I have a favorite decade? Oh, that's a good question. No, I don't. I have like movies from decades that I liked. Like in every decade, there seems to be one. Now, obviously, probably my most influential films were in the 80s. I grew up then, so, you know, The Fog and Carrie and even things like Full Metal Jacket, I loved at the time.
That's a great film. The first time I saw that film is like, oh, this is kind of funny, and then it just and that's another film that just does a completely 180 to something that's a lot more dark and...
Yeah. Yeah, and then I was always interested in films that people brought to me, because obviously normal television wouldn't really play them, and we became this little film group even in high school that's like, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen Clockwork Orange? And, you know, films that were a little out of people's grasp because we were so sheltered in this little small town in Germany that we were growing up in.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So before we got on to our listeners, we were talking about, Barbara had mentioned she was from Poland. And tell me a little about like your environment and your living environment and how that played an effect and kind of like how you grew up and then how you viewed films.
Well, I was born in Poland, but my parents moved us very, very fast to West Germany And so I grew up in this small German town, and I actually, my window in my bedroom was looking out at a cemetery. So basically 13 years of my life, I spent looking at a cemetery.
Oh, that's not creepy at all. Oh my gosh.
Did you have any weird
experiences from that?
The only time there was some weird experiences was when me and my best friend tried to play that game where you go for letters and you try to form words that some ghost is giving you. What's it called?
Oh, so Ouija board.
Oh yeah, Ouija board. So the only time I had a weird experience was with that, because we started to really focus on the board and try to move the, I think it was a glass actually we were using, and all of a sudden I got an electric shock, and so I just ran away. I wouldn't play it anymore. But other than that, nothing really supernatural has ever happened in my life, in spite of living in a next to the cemetery. So that's probably unusual.
Wow, I could not deal with that. I would just, I'd say, Mom, sorry, I'm like maybe sleep in the basement or something, or I don't know.
Yeah, no, it didn't even occur to me to be all that creepy until I started figuring it out that,
dead people are right there.
I actually found it quite peaceful, and I used to go to the cemetery to write, which I guess makes me really odd, but yeah, that was my teenage years.
Very cool. Now, I know a lot of people that do that, and some people will turn the other coin and say, hey, it's actually the most peaceful place you can go because there's not a lot of stuff going on. It's quiet.
Exactly. It was very nice. Nobody's bothering you.
Right, because they're all dead. Yeah. So how did that, so you kind of mentioned briefly about, having access to certain films and experiencing them years later. So was there a certain amount of censorship going on?
No, it's not so much censorship, but kind of figuring it out of where these movies are. Because, you know, as you're growing up in this small town, and your influences are different. They're more European. There's the art films. There's, you know, the European series. American influences really didn't start coming in until I was kind of out the door. And now everything in Germany is very Americanized, and there's a lot of movies. But whatever gets played on television was the regular stuff. It wasn't all that exciting. And it's only when I got into movies more and more that I started to see that there was this whole different world that I hadn't explored yet. So that was exciting.
Very cool. Yeah, it's great when it dawns on you that first time. I remember, you know, some of my most impressionable moments growing up in the 80s myself is when you discover those movies for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, even now, I mean, there's still a lot of stuff in back catalog that I'm still discovering.
Yeah, I saw Alien for the first time when I was 12, and I actually couldn't take it. I had to run out because it was too scary for me.
My earliest memory was Aliens Part 2, or the second one, Aliens. My folks took me to a drive-in theater, and mm-hmm. I was in the back seat of the car, and I remember the beginning of the film, Ripley is having a dream. And she's dreaming that she's got one of the gut buster aliens popping out of her stomach, and then she wakes up. That is one of my earliest childhood film going experience memories, and it's seared into my brain for the rest of my life.
Yes, isn't that amazing?
I'm like now that I think back on it, I'm like, Mom and Dad, what were you thinking taking me to the drive-in to see that when I was so young?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you feel like you will see it eventually, right? So
right. it was preparing me for what I'd see later in life, and because I've subsequently seen a lot worse films.
Yes, definitely. Me too. Yeah, I have that same experience from a scene in The Fog, which I saw very early, too. Like, I think I was 8 or so. And that scene where the hook goes, like, the pirates go into the car, the fog, the car stops, like, and it's broken, and the fog comes in, and then the hook goes through the windshield, and they, oh, my God, that scene is also just, for some reason, I know somebody would watch that movie now and go, like, there's nothing scary about this film, but when I saw it, it was terrifying.
Yeah, there's films like that for me, too, like, where I just remember being so terrified as a kid, and going back and watching them now, I'm like, this is just really silly. Like, I used to be terrified of all the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels.
Mm-hmm.
And like, when I go back and watch, like, the first one is still pretty good for what it is, but the, you know, as they started getting more of the sequels, it started getting a little bit more campy.
Mm-hmm.
And now I just laugh because then Freddy started becoming like just kind of like a slapstick humor type of guy. I'm like, how was I ever so just scared?
Right.
I am.
Yeah, it's weird how that happens, but it's also a shame that happens. You know, I wish that they hadn't gone quite that campy route, but I guess that's the 80s for you.
True. Yep. So how do you feel about the recent trend with a lot of films, and not just horror in particular, about remakes?
Well, honestly, not so hot. I like to watch original material. I understand why the studios do it, because it's a built-in audience. It's almost guaranteed to make your money back. It's a sure bet. Why not bet on the sure horse? I get it. It's, you know, if somebody wanted me to direct a remake of something, I wouldn't say no either. But then you see a movie that comes out that's original, and it makes the same amount of money, if not more, and then you wonder, well, maybe if you just told good stories, it would have the same effect. But I guess that takes a lot of work. So
it seems that way now. But although I'm hoping, and it seems like this year in particular, I'm starting to get a feeling that things might be swinging the other way. I think we've started off with a pretty good, and probably even the best, in my humble opinion, summer seasons for films in a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of early reviews that I'm reading about the J.J. Abrams, Steven Spielberg
mm-hmm.
venture Super 8
mm-hmm.
Has me really hopeful that we're starting to see the swing back to more character-driven stories, more films that are very engrossing and getting you more involved as a viewer. And just return to a more, it's just very character-driven type of film and something that is just really evolving.
In the end, you know, if you think about stories in the way that, well, every story has been told, that may be true, but if you tell us characters, it gives it a whole new edge, and I think good characters are what makes good stories. In a way. And not to go back to Christopher Nolan too much, but I feel like Inception of last year did a great service to the film world. And think of it what you may, whether it, you know, you loved it or hated it, but it was catering to a more intelligent audience. It was catering to an audience that liked to see original movies. And it showed the studios that can be done if you have a great original script with a concept that's appealing to people, that actually markets to people that, you know, you might be too dumb for this movie.
Right.
And people go and see it because they don't want to believe that. And they're not, you know, everybody got it.
Right.
So it's one of these really clever things, I think, did a lot of good for filmmaking.
Absolutely, and I think it proves to you the fact that no matter how many visuals you throw at something, when you boil down to the heart of that film, it was about a man trying to reclaim a life he used to have. And, like, who can't relate to that in some way? Either, I mean, even if you're not adversely affected by a situation like that, you may know of somebody or, you know, I think it's very relatable on a human level, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree.
And personally, and just to throw, and I'm not trying to throw him under the bus because I know James Cameron is a phenomenal filmmaker, but that's where I think personally he failed with Avatar. I thought it was too much CGI, too much special effects, and I didn't get that connection at all with any of the characters. So I think. Nolan is on the completely different end of the spectrum there in that regard. Like, it has the amazing visuals, it has, like, the jaw-dropping scenes, but at the end of the day, it's really about the character, the central character of the film.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a small film that got to be quite popular, well, at least within our circles, called Frozen.
Yes.
Which also was incredibly character-based.
You're talking about the Adam Green film, right? With the people that are stranded on the ski lift.
Yes, I love that movie.
I thought it was incredible, too. When I first heard about it, I'm like, how is this guy really going to draw this out into a feature-length film?
Mm-hmm. And I did it.
And personally, so he started off with, have you seen Hatchet?
I have not seen Hatchet, but I've heard about it.
It's pretty much your standard slasher type of film. I mean, there's nothing really too inventive about it, and you know it's okay for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really one of the first films I've seen him kind of step out and just really focus on character and something that's really, really different. I mean, I have a fear of flying, but I imagine for people that ski quite a bit, that must have struck a nerve. but I thought it was incredible because, you know, here you are, you have these three friends and they're stuck on a ski lift, and it's driven by, like, their anxieties as people.
Exactly.
The girlfriend worried about her dog back home, and, you know, just stuff that people just think about inherently, but, you know, when they get thrown in a situation like that, it just becomes more amplified.
Yeah, and their relationship between themselves, between each other, and their agendas, and the way that all comes to play, too, is so beautiful, but then you still have all the horror around it.
Right.
So it's still a really big concept movie in that, like, it's trying to do to skew the ocean, right?
Right.
But it's you understand these characters, you feel like you know them, you know people like that, and that's, I think, what makes a good movie.
Absolutely.
Please.
Yep.
Yeah.
So in closing, let's talk a little bit more about Fugue. What's next for the film? So you just recently released it on DVD. I got my copy in the mail. I'm looking forward to checking out the proper version on DVD and its 5.1 surround sound awesomeness.
Yeah, and also has really fun outtakes. At least I think they're fun, and some deleted scenes too. So, and our audio commentary.
Very cool. I'll be checking it out. This actually, my wife and I will be in San Diego this weekend, so we're looking forward to that. But when I
great
yeah when I get back, I'll be checking it out.
Okay, now you buy the DVD directly from us, which is on our website, if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely. No, plug your film, please.
www.fuguethefilm.com, and Fugue is spelled F-U-G-U-E, and then fuguethefilm, one word, .com. So, yes, we can buy it directly from us. We're cheaper than Amazon.com, where it's also at right now. And then it's starting to play, ironically, we're starting to play on the smallest possible gadgets, which is the cell phones and the iPads. So it's going out into digital distribution first, and, you know, we'll see. Maybe we can build a bigger following so that we can get some other platforms, but,
is that
kind of where it's at right now with independent.
Great. Is that so when you say that it's on some of the digital mediums, is it like on a video on demand type service, or is it?
Yeah, it is. We're going to be on an application called Gigaplex?
Gigaplex? Okay.
Yeah, it's Gigaplex. So we can be viewed there in about, I think, a week or so. And then we're working on Netflix and iTunes. So with our sales agent.
Very cool. That's great to hear. Any other screenings or festivals, or is it pretty much just going through the route right now, trying to get it out there through digital means and selling through your website?
Yeah, mostly we were a little bit done with festivals because we did them for the past year, and then we should probably send it out again and do a nice batch into film festivals. But no, right now we don't have any screenings coming up.
Cool. Sounds good. Barbara, I really appreciate your time, and I'm glad we could finally connect after going back and forth for like the last month and conflicting schedules. And
oh, no problem. I don't mind that at all. That happens.
Continued best of luck, really, though. A phenomenal film, and I'll continue to say as much as I can on my little blog. But
thank you so much. I really appreciate the support. We're, you know, small movie, and so the more help we get, the better.
Absolutely. Cool. I can't wait to check out what you've got coming next, and I hope we stay in touch.
Yeah, I hope so, too. That'd be nice.
Thank you, Barbara. And everybody listening, this is our official sign-off. Thank you, and we'll catch you later.
Thank you. David.